You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Now I'm a union man, amazed at what I am. I say what I think, that the company stinks. Yes, I'm a union man. When we meet in the local hall, I'll be voting with them all. With a hell of a shout, it's out, brothers, out, and the rise of the company's fall.
Oh, you don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. You don't get me, I'm part of the union. Till the day I die. Till the day I die.
As a union woman, I'm wise to the lies of the company spies.
And she don't.
Good morning, members and listeners to 3CR Radical Radio Melbourne. This is Fire Up MUA. My name's David Bull. I come from the Victorian branch of the MUA. I'm here with one of my usual co-hosts, Aaron Full Moon. How are you going, Aaron?
Good, David. How are you?
The ghost has disappeared, but I'm sure he'll be here shortly. We've also got a very special guest here today with us, and that is Thomas Mayo. How are you, Thomas?
Yeah, good. Thanks, guys.
Pretty excited about having you in Melbourne today, mate. And we know during the week you are... did a very special presentation at our monthly stop work meeting, which was actually yesterday because of Anzac Day. And we're going to record some of that speech and hopefully get you to give a bit of an introduction to it now.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to speaking to the members of the MUA in Victoria branch, the mighty MUA, and other comrades that are coming to join us from the Trades and Labour Council and other unions. So it's a great opportunity to just update everybody. Remind them of where we've come from, and give some some inspiration, because we've got a lot of hard work to do over the coming months to win this referendum.
So, Tom, our union's had a pretty strong history in supporting our First Nation comrades through their struggles, dating back to the Waverley walk-off and before that, mate. This is just a continuation of that campaigning and that support. How is the referendum campaign going?
Yeah, well, we've got a lot of challenges. We've got the Liberals and the Nationals officially against us now for the No campaign, along with Pauline Hanson and some other grubs from the right wing. They're going to be doing their best to try and confuse Australians to cause them to vote no. The polling has held up pretty well, although we've had a bit of a hit in the Roy Morgan polling fairly recently. The campaign is yet to really lift off. The online shop is for Yes 23 is up, and people can get shirts. We've got organisations from our unions all the way through to businesses and everything in between supporting this. We've got the Greens supporting this solidly now, and really it's about the people, not politicians anyway, and that's who we're going to be speaking to over the next few months to help them understand.
Thank God they got rid of Lydia.
Yeah, well, she's got a different opinion, I respect that people can have different opinions, but I hope that people look at the logic behind this, the history of the struggle that leads to, needing a constitutionally enshrined voice, not one that is just legislated. It certainly doesn't make sense to keep doing more of the same, which, is an argument that has been made by Senator Thorpe and Senator Price and others that, the government should just do the right thing and put more money into programs and implement the recommendations from the Royal Commission reports. What is missing is unapologetic representation from Indigenous people, where a parliament and the executive government are required to listen and that we have the funding to organise in an effective way, but protected by the Constitution, so they can never take it away from us again. And that's something different. We need to try something different, and because the status quo just isn't good enough.
Thanks heaps, Thomas, for coming along today and introducing yourself live to the great show that you put on yesterday. And we look forward to listening to it, and I'm sure members and listeners will enjoy it. Thanks, Annie, for recording it. Yeah, I'm 3CR, the most progressive radio station in Victoria, and we really appreciate all your efforts.
What I'm going to be talking about is a once-in-generations opportunity. It's not just once in a generation. This is something that we are not going to have another shot at in our lifetimes. And that is the matter of justice for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, for recognition of our existence, of our long connection to this country, and that we deserve the decency of a say when decisions are made about us. And we should understand that, comrades, as workers and union members. The way I'll do this is I'm going to share with you the way that I understand the importance of this. I'll talk about my own experience as a union member, as an activist, and on the road in this journey to this referendum. And really, for me, comrades, it begins on the wharf. I started on the wharf when I was 17 years old in 1994. And I was on the wharf like many of you in the room here back in the 1998 Patrick's dispute. And as a wharfie, I saw the community come out and support us, other unions, the solidarity that we needed to be able to get back into the gates and get our jobs back. And I realised that that was because of the way that we have used our power as workers, not just for our own wages and conditions, but to support others in society, the most vulnerable, for social justice, the things that made me very proud to be a union member and a wharfie in my early time on the wharves. And I'll just mention some of those things that make me very proud to be a wharfie and a union member. It's how unions and the MUA supported the Gurindji Wayfield walk-off. I was on the wharf working with a guy named Brian Manning before he retired. And Brian Manning was just one of the wharfies that regularly took supplies that had come from the wharves all around the country, us doing the tarpaulin musters, chipping in, taking supplies from Darwin down to Gurindji country to support that 9-year-long struggle. And for those that don't know about the Wavehill walk-off and the Gurindji people, and the leader of the Gurindji people, Vincent Lingyari, it was 200 Aboriginal workers, stockmen, domestics and their families, that walked off Wavehill Station in 1966 in protest for equal wages at the time. And it became a struggle for land rights. It went for 9 years, and it culminated in that moment when Gough Whitlam became the Prime Minister, travelled to Gurindji country, and there's that iconic photo of Gough Whitlam standing with Vincent Lingyari and pouring a handful of sand into Lingyari's, a symbolic gesture of giving some land back for the first time. Now, I'll just digress a moment on this, because the Gurindji people are great supporters of this referendum campaign, because they understand that when we won some land back, when we win land back, when we make advances in this country, the Lingyari and Gurindji people's dream was to live on their land their way. Something simple, something fair, something decent, something you think they should have always had. But when they had their land back, they were subject to the laws and policies made thousands of kilometres away in Canberra, and their dream was denied. Their dream was denied by the Northern Territory Country Liberal Party, a very racist party, a party that was involved in the Rights for Whites rallies in Katherine, a nearby town, to try and stop land rights. The sabotage, the regulations and the laws that were strictly applied on the Gurindji people that simply wanted to raise cattle and practice their culture as they'd done for tens of thousands of years on their country, and they were denied at every turn. And in the 1980s, the mining company and the cattle company that they established ceased to exist. And they understand you need the influence over the laws and policies that control how you are able to live in and enjoy your land. The 1946 Pilbara strike is another such struggle, where pastoral station workers, Aboriginal workers again, only paid in rations, walked off across the Pilbara, and wharfies and seafarers refused to export the cargoes from those pastoral stations in solidarity with those workers. Now, what we need to understand with this is that the Gurindji people and the workers in the Pilbara and across the country in those times were slaves. They were slaves, comrades. They were only paid in rations, a bit of beef, a bit of beef bone, tobacco, tea, bit of sugar, working 16-hour days or more, no time for recreation, no time to bury their dead with dignity. If you're only getting enough sustenance to turn up to work in those conditions every day, then you're slaves. That's what it was. And our union was there, in support, like many other unions in those times. I'll go all the way back to the 1920s now. Something else that made me proud to be a wharfie. The first all-Aboriginal political organisation, the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association. The leader of that was a guy named Fred Maynard, a Warramai man, a wharfie. Undoubtedly had the support and the solidarity of his fellow wharfies, and this is something that we should be proud of. This is union business, what I'm telling you today. I learnt the value of unity through the Patrick's dispute and through many other struggles as wharfies. And I learnt that unity is more than a word that you just say at a rally or in a forum like this, but it takes structure, it takes discipline, it takes rules, it takes the ability to choose your own representatives and hold your representatives to account, to come together regularly and reach a consensus so that you can go out there with coherency and fight for what your people want. That is what I learnt on the wharves. Now, I became a delegate soon after the Patrick's dispute. And I was a wharfie for 16 years, a delegate for a long time. And I became an official in 2010. And I continued that tradition that our union has of supporting others in our society, not just using our leverage of unity just for our own wages and conditions. And in joining my own people's struggles against injustices like when Tony Abbott was Prime Minister, he cut hundreds of millions of dollars from frontline community services that led to the WA government announcing that they were going to basically close down over 100 communities in Western Australia just by cutting off those services, causing our people to go either into further poverty or to be refugees from their own land into places where they still weren't welcome. People that were on those lands for over 60,000 years. Now, that was an injustice. Another example is in 2016, you might remember the Four Corners report. I was watching it with my wife. I was shocked to see the treatment of youth in detention in the Don Dale facility in Darwin. Children as young as 10, basically being tortured, being abused, not doing those kids any good because they were being damaged for the rest of their lives. Not doing the victims of crime any good because it just perpetuates that cycle and continues it because we know tough on crime doesn't work. Just continue to abuse those children, and we saw that and we organised rallies to these things and actions, as we do, comrades. But what I started to learn is that our advocacy for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people is far too ineffective. And there's this cycle of activism that we see, that when an injustice is fresh, we get good numbers on the streets, we turn out. It's always hard to keep people turning up about the same issue. And the governments have ways of diminishing our momentum. We demand inquiries, and we get them. At best, we get a royal commission. But what happens? They take months, many months, sometimes years. The recommendations come out about deaths in custody, about youth in detention, and those recommendations are ignored. And the ones that are implemented are not done in a proper way with our people, and then they fail. So this cycle of activism. We also see this incoherency, because in the lack of a structure behind our unity, anybody can put up their hand and say they speak for blackfellas today on national issues. A politician, political party like the Country Liberal Party, can choose someone like Senator Price and say she speaks for blackfellas today. Imagine that in our union movement, comrades, if we didn't have our local on the job, our branches in our states or regions, our national representative bodies, our national union. If we didn't have that, we'd be a rabble. And we see this incoherency where you can get five speakers on the stump and 10 different solutions to one problem. This is a problem for us. This is why politicians are not being held to account. It's why we're failing to make progress. It's not that we're not making any progress, but we can do better. Now, in 2016, I was invited to one of 13 dialogues around the country. I learned that this was run by the Referendum Council, and the Referendum Council itself came through struggle. Those issues that I was talking about, we were going backwards. The gap was widening. And 39 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander leaders demanded a meeting with the Prime Minister and the opposition leader and said, we need a discussion, we need action on this. And from that meeting that was at Kirribilli House came the Kirribilli Statement. And it proposed two things that are important to this. Firstly, it said when it comes to constitutional recognition, and it was something that had been in the national discourse for a long time, but it said when it comes to constitutional recognition, we need more than symbolism. We need something that gives our people greater fairness. And secondly, it said that we need the establishment of a referendum council to take this question to our people and to broader Australia to understand what form of constitutional recognition we could accept. And these dialogues came from that referendum council, the process of 13 dialogues. They were well informed. They had intense lessons on civics. They were done to a formula of 100 participants to ensure that there was a cross-section of our perspectives and experiences as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Now, this is really important because what was explained by Professor Megan Davis, an Aboriginal woman, an expert in public law, is that you have an open invitation to these types of things. Then you risk those that are most practiced at being heard, like I was at the time, dominating the discussions and skewing the results. There needed to be the space for our quieter advocates, the advocates that work on healing, the advocates that do the frontline services. Not just the loudest, but a cross-section of views and perspectives. These dialogues culminated at Uluru with a final convention where delegates from those dialogues came together in late May 2017. And our job was to synthesise the priorities set in those dialogues and bring it together in one collective statement. After 3 days at Uluru, we endorsed the Uluru Statement from the heart, and it was received with standing acclamation and tears of joy and hope. Now, comrades, I'll recite the Uluru Statement from the heart before I go on to why what it calls for is so important, where we are up to politically today, and what we can do to make sure that we win. We gathered at the 2017 National Constitutional Convention, coming from all points of the southern sky, make this statement from the heart. Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes were the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands, and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This our ancestors did according to the reckoning of our culture from the creation, according to the common law from time immemorial, and according to science more than 60,000 years ago. This sovereignty is a spiritual notion, the ancestral tie between the land or Mother Nature and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who were born therefrom, remain attached thereto, and must one day return thither to be united with our ancestors. This link is the basis of the ownership of the soil, or better, of sovereignty. It has never been ceded or extinguished, and it coexists with the sovereignty of the Crown. How could it be otherwise, that a people's possessed the land for 60 millennia and this sacred link disappears from world history in merely the last 200 years? With substantive constitutional change and structural reform, we believe this ancient sovereignty can shine through as a fuller expression of Australia's nationhood. Proportionately, we are the most incarcerated people on the planet. We are not an innately criminal people. Our children, are alien from their families at unprecedented rates. This cannot be because we have no love for them. And our youth languish in detention in obscene numbers. They should be our hope for the future. These dimensions of our crisis tell plainly the structural nature of our problem. This is the torment of our powerlessness. We seek constitutional reforms to empower our people and take a rightful place in our own country. When we have power over our destiny, our children will flourish, they will walk in two worlds, and their culture will be a gift to their country. We call for the establishment of a First Nations voice enshrined in the Constitution. Makarrata is the culmination of our agenda, the coming together after a struggle. It captures our aspirations for a fair and truthful relationship with the people of Australia and a better future for our children based on justice and self-determination. We seek a Makarrata Commission to supervise a process of agreement-making between governments and First Nations and truth-telling about our history. In 1967, we were counted. In 2017, we seek to be heard. We leave base camp and start our trek across this vast country. We invite you to walk with us in a movement of the Australian people for a better future. It's a Uluru statement. Comrades, in the dialogues and at Uluru, we also had a film by Rachel Perkins, world-class filmmaker, daughter of Charlie Perkins, that took us all, and you know, even our own mob don't understand, a lot of our mob don't know the history of our struggle, and that was important to cover, to understand all of the things that had been tried before, that had failed, all of the statements and petitions that come before the Uluru Statement, and there's many. The 1930s, William Cooper, one of the great leaders of the times, there was a petition to the King. 1963, the Yirrkala Bark petitions, trying to protect country, the Yolngu people, a petition to the federal parliament. 1972, the Larrakia petition to the Queen, just to mention several. And all of these statements and petitions have been dismissed and ignored. And all of those statements and petitions called for a voice. And like we do, like what is natural as human beings, you organise power by coming together and having that structure. And over again, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have set up voices. And sometimes we've been able to convince governments to do that. Like the one from the Barunga Statement in 1988. Bob Hawke set up ATSIC. Like the NAC under Whitlam, I think it was. But every time another government has come along, they have silenced that voice. Over and over again, we have called for a voice. Over and over again, it has been silenced. And we have learnt, and this is why, the Uluru Statement proposes a voice enshrined in the Constitution. That is the key proposal. The Uluru Statement also proposes a Makarrata Commission to supervise a process of agreement-making between governments and First Nations and truth-telling about our history. Think of the Constitution like this, comrades. All it is the rule book of the nation. And we understand that if we are to put our voice out of the reach of hostile governments, we've got to put it in the rule book, that only the Australian people, the will of the Australian people, can change and protect from bastards like Howard that always come along. Because Howard silenced ATSIC. And what Howard led a lot of Australians to believe is that ATSIC was a failure. Just like they tried to help make Australians believe that unions were a problem in this country. And they tried to say that we were corrupt, our officials, and that we were lazy. As a 20-year-old wharfie, I knew these things not to be true. But he softened up the Australian public before he moved the mercenaries in 1998 to try and destroy our union and go after every other union in the country. And he failed. Because of the solidarity from the community, because of our well-established union, because we were used to negotiating, because our officials have looked after our money and we had the resources to take up the fight. But in a country that was much less favourable towards Indigenous people in those times, it was catastrophic. And he got the Latham Labor Opposition Party to support it, and he silenced that voice like all the others. So we know we must do different this time, comrades. And we know if we don't have a voice, then people are exploited, They're ignored. They're degraded. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, just like workers, know we need to establish a voice. Because the sentiment of the Australian people is with us, but we've got to do the work to help them understand. I just want to address a couple of misconceptions before I conclude. This isn't about race, as some are saying. Indigenous people have rights in this country as a people that are distinct, that have a connection. For over 60,000 years, we're human like everyone else. We deserve our rightful place in this country. The race power is already in the Constitution, Section 5126, and it has been used to discriminate against us. The Hindmarsh case in the 90s established that that power is not necessarily for the benefit of Indigenous people, but it can be used to our detriment. And we don't seek to remove that because some beneficial laws come from that power, but we seek a voice to ensure that it is used for our benefit and that we have political influence to make sure that policies and legislation furthers our place in this country and doesn't take us backwards. Also, the Treaty First argument is coming strong here from Tasmania and people like Senator Thorpe. It's okay for different opinions amongst our people. That played out at Uluru. 20 out of 270 walked out. We're not homogenous any more than union members are. But it's illogical to say treaty must come first. Firstly, because treaties are already happening in the states and the Northern Territory, the processes are underway. So it's like calling for something that's already happening. But secondly, they're going to take decades to achieve. Treaty experts say treaties are going to be decades away, 30 to 40 years. Senator Thorpe herself has said in forums at least 20 years. So do we wait at least 20 years, an unknown amount of time, for an unknown outcome? Because it's an agreement, comrades. It's not going to just fall in our laps. We're going to have to negotiate the terms of a treaty. Why would we wait that long before we build greater power to address the common issues in our communities? Housing, the justice system, health, education, employment, all of these things that we need to do as a people. It's ridiculous. Also, constitutional recognition, comrades, is something that other like countries have already done. We're way behind. There is no progress if Australia votes no. And I'm just going to address this final one. I've heard some people say, so-called progressives, that if Australia votes no, then that might be a good thing. No, it's not. It's not even status quo. It's worse. It's Australia officially saying no to the very existence of our people. It's Australia saying no to the decency and the fairness of us having a say. And so we must fight for yes. Thank you.
I'll introduce a song about our great friends, the Gurindji people, who are big supporters of this referendum campaign, because I understand what it's like to win some land back but not have enough influence over the laws and policies that decide how you can live on your land. And that was the dream of the Gurindji people, to live on their land their way. So the song is by Paul Kelly and Kevin Carmody from Little Things, Big Things Grow.
Thanks, members.
Thanks, members.
Thanks, Annie.
It's a great privilege and an honour to be here to celebrate the legacy of this old man. We always felt he was a comrade in our camp. So I feel it's a celebration. So if you want to sing along to this, you will not be removed by security.
Gather around, people. Tell you a story, an 80-year-long story of power and pride. British Lord Vesty and Vincent Lingyari were opposite men on opposite side.
Vesty was fat honey and muscle. Beef was his business, broad was his door. Vincent was lean, spoke very little. He had no bank balance, our dirt was his floor. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Gurindji were working for nothing but rations, but once they had gathered the wealth of the land, daily the pressure got tighter and tighter. Gurindji decided they must make a stand.
They picked up their swags, started off walking at what he did. Sat himself down, now it don't sound like much. Sure got tongues talking back at the homestead, then in the town. From little things, big things grow. Kaya, from little things, big things grow.
I'll double your wages, 7 quid a week you have in your hand. Vincent said, uh-uh, we're not talking about wages. We're staying right here till we get our land.
Bestie man roared, bestie man thundered. You don't stand a chance of a cinder in snow. It said if we fall, others arising. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Then Vincent Ligari boarded an aeroplane, landed in Sydney, great big city of lights. And daily he went round, softly speaking his story to all kinds of men from all walks of life.
Vincent sat down with a big politician. This affair, they told him, it's a matter of state. Let us sort it out. Your people are hungry. Vincent said, no thanks. We know how to wait. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Then Vincent Lingyari returned in an airplane back to his country once more to sit down. He told his people, let the stars keep on turning. We got friends in the south, in the cities and towns.
Eight years went by, eight long years away. One day a tall stranger appeared in the land. And he came with lawyers, came with great ceremony, through Vincent's fingers, poured that handful of sand. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Story of Vincent Lingyari, but this is a story of something much more.
How power and privilege can move people to know where they stand. They stand in their law.
From little things, big
things grow from little things. Big things grow from little things. Big things grow from little things. Big things grow from little things. Big things grow from little things. Big things grow.
Our spirit walks with you.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.